One of our real Wisconsin treasures, the UW-Madison Arboretum, is celebrating its 75th anniversary. And as part of that celebration, we're really fortunate to have participating in it Joseph Inglesby of Marshfield, Massachusetts, an internationally known environmental artist. And I'm really pleased to have him along today to talk with us about his work as we visit about vanishing landscapes and endangered species. He will be making an artist presentation coming up this Saturday at the Arboretum Visitors Center. And so we'll talk about that as well, and certainly take your questions as we go along today. And if you have a question, I hope you'll join us. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org, and we'd love to hear from you. And Joseph Inglesby is with me in the studio. Joseph, hi. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you very much.
Over the next half century or so, about a third of the world's plant and animal species maybe we lost, I think, forever. And that's part of the inspiration, I think, for your work, or the reason for the artistic work that you do.
Yes, a lot of the work that I do is collaborative in nature. So I work with scientists, I work with communities, I try and develop a vocabulary that is outside of the normal scientific and academic vocabulary. So I try to popularize the information. And this occurred when I was attending conferences on estuaries, and the scientists were like canaries in a coal mine, speaking of all of the issues, but you know, it never went beyond the closed doors. So I decided to collaborate with the scientists and develop a visual language to try and popularize this information for the general public.
And talk about that. You say a visual language. What does that mean?
Well, in the past, what I had done is before the computer, before I became a facile with a computer, I did large-scale analytical drawings of landscapes. And, for example, for the city of Philadelphia, what I'd do is I would look at the Schuylkill River, and I'd look at its historical overlays of its infrastructural changes of technology that occurred over the years and how that impacted the Schuylkill River. Well, now what I do is I work with a computer, and you can layer via GIS and Photoshop and other techniques the same sort of information.
Well, you have some fascinating, some beautiful, beautiful work, and your work is going to be, some of it's going to be presented, sort of a retrospective, is it not?
Yes, it is. You know, the work spans approximately 20 years, and will include works from New England as well as from the Midwest, including icons of the vanishing prairies, silent shadows, crane effigy mounds, spirits of whooping cranes, shrouds for an endangered species, the landscape mosaics, leaves and grass, requiem of a drowning landscape, and anadromous awakening. So essentially, it's a review of landscapes from the Mississippi to the Atlantic, using art and art installations.
And it's all available for anyone from anywhere in Wisconsin or any place else for that matter to come and see.
That's true. The show runs through the 29th of June at the Steinhauer Gallery, Trust Gallery, at the University of Wisconsin-Madison Arboretum.
It's going to be a wonderful experience for many people, I know, to view this. What you've worked a lot on the East Coast, and now you're working here in the Midwest. I know you have some work going on, a lot of work at the Nisida National Wildlife Refuge. But what are the differences? Are you seeing any differences between the work, kind of work you did on the East Coast and what you're doing now here?
Well, there are differences as well as similarities. There are issues that are constant to both landscapes. For example, on the East Coast, there are issues with climate change, with sea level rise, with broken tropic cascades, and I can explain what those are, changes of species. And you have the same happening here. There are effects of climate change. You have a fragmentation of the landscape. You have similar issues.
What, of course, you've been doing this for a while. What impact do you feel your work has had in different places?
Well, I had a show recently in New York City at the Hall of Science, and it was called Requiem for a Drowning Landscape. And it reached it has the largest visitation of a science museum, I think, in the country. So it reached all generations of people, from school children to the elderly, had a chance to see it. And there'll be other additional installations that will reach wider audiences. So I try and make it sort of popularize it to a degree.
Mm-hmm. And talk about your experiences at the UW-Madison Arboretum. You've been a fairly frequent visitor of the Arboretum.
Yes, I have. I've been learning a great deal. You know, Wisconsin, I think, is on the cutting edge of environmental restoration in this country. And I think the Arboretum is following a tradition of John Muir and Aldo Leopold. And that tradition continues to this day. The Arboretum isn't an arboretum in terms of collections of trees, which is your usual definition. In this instance, it's a teaching and educational institution that's actually doing the work on the ground, following the tradition of Aldo Leopold. So they're actually restoring the prairies. They're using fire as a means of suppressing tree growth and weed growth and regenerating the prairies. And they're reaching out to the public. So my exhibition, I think, follows within their general guidelines, I guess, of what they're trying to do.
Yeah, and what will you be speaking on?
Well, it's going to be about following the vanishing landscapes and endangered species. I'll be talking about the fragmentation of the natural and cultural landscape. And in this instance, what I'll be looking at are a series of overlays. I want to take it initially historically through what actually brought about this fragmentation historically. And so there will be changes of technology, changes of law, sort of the politics of it, to bring it to the present day, and then how my work fits within the description, I suppose, of what is the fragmentation and how has it affected the natural and cultural landscape, in this case, with vanishing landscapes and endangered species.
We're talking today with Joseph Inglesby of Marshfield, Massachusetts, internationally known environmental artist. His work combines art, science, and technology to advocate for the vanishing landscapes and endangered species. I'm really pleased to have him with us today. If you have a question or comment as we move along today, you're welcome to join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. It's talk@wpr.org. So give us a call, shoot us an email. We'll be glad to get you on the air. And I have some callers coming up online now. I also wanted to mention that you are the kind of artist in residence at the Nisida National Wildlife Refuge in Nisida, Wisconsin, and working on a crane effigy mounds project. And I find this a fascinating project as well. You talk about the project and how far along you are with it.
Well, what I've been doing is I've been listening to both the Ho-Chunk Nation with visits with the traditional court, as well as with the community. And I wanted to try and develop something that wouldn't conflict with the sacred effigy mounds that there are so many, but so few actually left in Wisconsin and the Midwest now, and to try and pay homage to that, and also pay homage to the return of the whooping crane. So I did this through a series of castings, initially to develop models for the work, that show a crane mound and a crane intaglio. An intaglio is a depression. The crane I'm using is a water bird that would represent the transition between, in the cosmology, the underworld or the watery world and that of the heavens. So it's a transitional symbol to me. So the intaglio is usually representative of a piece, an effigy mound, that would be close to water. The crane mound, which the crane has not, to my knowledge, been used by the woodland peoples mm-hmm. in the traditional effigy mounds, which date back 70 to 1200 AD, during, I suppose, the golden period of that. So what it involves here is a hill that would have a wrapped serpent, in this case a Massasauga rattlesnake, wrapped around it in order to give you a ramp to as an overlook to the piece. The intaglio would be on the lower level, and then rising up on a slope would be the mound of the bird in flight. We're using this also as a model of prairie restoration because currently the site adjacent to the regional airport in Nisida is completely overgrown with invasive species. So we would eliminate the invasive species and reestablish the prairie and also try and establish the habitat with the blue lupin plant for the Karner blue butterfly.
Yes.
So there are three endangered species that mm-hmm. are represented here, the Massasauga rattlesnake, the whooping crane,
and
the Karner blue butterfly. So we're sort of in process. It's a long dialogue that's necessary in order to do this, but the village is committed to this. We have offers of help from both the state and others to try and restore the prairie and to do the initial earthwork. And I've brought with me a casting that could be used as a cornerstone for this park. Mm-hmm. Now, it may be that the whooping cranes would be represented through different plant materials for color and different color and texture. But I think I'd be using little blue stem and other typical plants mm-hmm. and forbs, grasses and forbs of the prairie here.
It's wonderful. Let's take some calls. Michael in Milwaukee will give you a chance first. Michael, hello. Thank you for calling.
Yes, hello, Larry and Joe. I hope I have your name right. Is that Joe again?
Joseph, yes.
Yeah,
Joseph.
Yes, sir. Yeah, good to talk to you. Great show as always, Larry. I don't know where to start. I have a lot of questions about environmental issues. I used to think that when I went to college in the early 70s, they had, of course, the initiation of Earth Day, et cetera, and some of these things. And I kind of thought it was maybe a flash in a pan or a fad or something that would was not really of importance. I always thought that money was the prime motivator, et cetera, of mankind, et cetera. You know? Mm-hmm. So, but I've come to change my attitude along the way here. I love Nisida, and I hope to see your whooping cranes and all your sculptures and et cetera. But I do have a question about Aldo Leopold, and I hope I'm not diverting from the main issue here. He, I believe, has some... he is around Baraboo, etc. His descendants have a place mm-hmm. there, and how does this? How is his effort to help the environment existing today mm-hmm. There? And can we visit that?
Mm-hmm. Well, my reading is that he's a contemporary Thoreau, that only he's an activist Thoreau. He was out in the field. He kept the journals as Thoreau kept his journals. But in this case, he put it into action. And I think the Arboretum is reflective of his philosophy.
His work, he was one of the prime movers of the University of Wisconsin Arboretum. And his work and his what they call the shack, where he... was kind of his home away from home, where he did a lot of his work and a lot of his research. Certainly is it is possible to spend time at that facility. So, thank you very much. And in fact, his daughter Nina Leopold Bradley still lives and and will probably be participating in the I wouldn't be surprised if she wasn't participating in the Arboretum events this weekend. Thanks, Michael, for calling. Mike in Oshkosh, we move to you next. Hi, Mike.
Hi, good morning. I just had a comment on something that I don't hear about, but I think it really affects the environment from the, you know, the bottom species all the way up to the top is, it's a fungus, and I'm hoping I get the pronunciation right. I believe it's a chytrid fungus, a chytrid fungus that's killing, like, all the frogs and amphibians, which, and you know, I noticed, I'm from Boston, or actually Lowell, Massachusetts, and, mm-hmm. you know, noticed as a kid, there would always be tons of frogs and toads, you know, when you're out cutting the lawn, and I noticed, you know, throughout the years, even I still travel through the woods and everything, and I don't see it anymore. And then I also see other species that used to be plentiful, and I know they've had, they've lost habitat and pollution and climate change, but on top of that, they have this fungus now that are, you know, invading the wetlands.
I don't know, Joseph, you may or may not know about this particular fungus, but I'm sure you can talk in general about the vanishing species, the endangered species that we have.
Yeah, well, a lot has to do with the habitat loss, for one. If you look at the prairies, for example, east of the Rockies, we've lost 99% of the tall grass prairie. If you look at the original old-growth forest, or so-called virgin forest, we've lost 99%. And if you were to look at the corresponding mapping that showed that happening over time, which, especially during the 19th century, you saw a real loss of landscape, you see the corresponding species implications here. For example, the passenger pigeon. The passenger pigeon was, just in terms of the sheer numbers, I think was second only to the Rocky locust, Rocky Mountain locust, which was the largest volume of animal life in the world, from what I've read. Well, the passenger pigeon, of course, we lost the passenger pigeons. They're extinct. But if you look at the habitat map, you can see that corresponded with that. Plus, there were introduced diseases that were brought in from a chicken, so domestic poultry. Well, you know, that's one example of how native species are affected by invasive species. And I think with the frogs, and I'm familiar with both the acidification and the shrinking of the habitat, the temperature changes that are all impacting the frog. I'm not personally familiar with the fungus that you're talking about. I know certainly with the bats, that's an issue. But I can mention on the salt marsh plants, which you know living on the coast, that what happens is when animals and plant life are weakened, it allows disease to come in. So, for example, with the incremental rise of the sea on the salt marshes, the Spartina patens marsh is affected. So it's meant to only be inundated during the spring high tide and during hurricanes. But now it's being inundated with each tide in some areas. So, for example, on Wellfleet Bay, where I've done a lot of work in Wellfleet, Massachusetts, there is scientific data on pathogens that are affecting both pathogens and galls, and additional work has been done up and down the coast by estuarine scientists on that. So disease does follow a weakening, and the weakening is caused by stress.
Yeah. Thank you very much for calling. Joseph Ingoldsby, our guest today, as we talk about vanishing landscapes and endangered species. He will be at the UW-Madison Arboretum on June 21st, this Saturday, as a matter of fact, at the Arboretum Visitor Center, speaking as part of the Arboretum's 75th anniversary. Questions for him or comments, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking vanishing landscapes and endangered species today with Joseph Ingoldsby of Marshfield, Massachusetts, internationally known environmental artist. Joseph, the let's talk for a little about, you've mentioned prairies off and on here in responding to questions and comments. What is the impact of, let's talk about the impact of our prairies on us.
Well, this is a unique landscape, and it essentially reflects the soils, the hydrology, the geology. It's part of that layering of the landscape. And what I wanted to speak about, certainly in the fragmentation aspects of the natural and cultural landscape, are impacts on the land. So what I'd like to do is perhaps just talk maybe historically and bring it up to contemporary times. So let's look at what the survey did. You know, initially there was a land ordinance, I think it was 1785, that broke the land up into townships, and it was a grid system versus a system based on a rivers, a rock, a tree, a certain natural landscape, which it had been in the original New England colonies. That gave sort of the impetus to development of the Northwest Ordinance, which was developed, I think, in around 1787, I think it was. And that was looking at Wisconsin, among other states, adjacent to the Great Lakes. And this was another empowering aspect of the manifest destiny of moving west, colonizing the West. That coupled with industrial invention, for example, the railroad. You can look at the maps of, say, the Central Pacific and Union Pacific railroads, and you see a network that crisscrosses this country. And oftentimes the roads and the railroads were based on the trails that were developed by the American bison. So that came into, so you have that, and then you also have the development of the plow by John Deere. Now that happened, I believe it was in Grand Detour, Illinois, where he finally developed the plow that broke the plains. And this was a polished steel blade that could cut through the deep sod and through the clay material, and it allowed the prairies to be opened up for agriculture. And most of the prairie loss, a landscape loss of the prairies, is towards agriculture, because this is the breadbasket of the nation. But that was one of the impetuses. But there's a cause and then there's an effect. So with the plow and without sustainable agriculture in place, and with prolonged drought being an issue, because this is a landscape of fire, it's a landscape of extremes, you had an extended drought period in the 1930s, which brought about the great Dust Bowl that was so bad that these clouds of dust even reached Washington, D.C., and the congressman finally passed legislation about this, as sort of to protect and to restore, only after they had to use wet handkerchiefs in order to breathe from the Capitol building to their carriage. So it affected the nation. And, of course, it was brought about, I think, legislative change on through the Roosevelt administration and looking at that. So it's quite devastating. Looking at some of the archival photographs of this, you see buildings that are almost up to their windowsills in shifting soils. You see the wagon wheels completely covered in this blowing soil. And, of course, it brought an exodus from the prairie. So those are a few of the aspects that are, and you can take it to today. Look at the infrastructure that's gone in place, you know, once again, through the survey system, through changes of technology, through sprawl. And, you know, the landscape is always an additive and subtractive process, but there's been more subtraction than addition. What I find really remarkable about the state of Wisconsin, and this is as an outsider looking in, is that the state agencies, the nonprofits, the educational institutions are all sort of following those footsteps of Aldo Leopold and John Muir. They're very activist, I think, in terms of restoration, in terms of trying to bring about a change. And that also not only is for the landscape, but also for the species. So you're blessed with organizations like the International Crane Foundation, Operation Migration, some of the Eastern Partnership, and other conservation groups that are working, for example, on the whooping crane. But other groups through the state agencies are looking at the Carnivore Blue Butterfly, are looking at the Massasauga Rattlesnake. Mm-hmm. And so there's an education and an activism that I haven't seen in other parts of the country, because it comes together here. It seems that everyone is working hand in hand. They're not working against one another. They're working together to bring about positive change.
And I think a lot of that is represented in the UW-Madison Arboretum.
That's very true. Certainly, as I had mentioned, that they use techniques to restore the prairies. They have educational programs, as I mentioned, fire, the reseeding, removal of invasives, return of certain species. As a matter of fact, I was there this morning, and a whooping crane walked past the plate glass window. So they've done a very good job.
Let's take some more calls. Jim in Superior will give you an opportunity now. Hello, Jim.
Well, hello. Your guest is just a fountain of all kinds of great information and bringing up Aldo Leopold quite often. And I'm just sitting here looking at my computer, and there's a program up north along the lines of some of the things he's been saying. And the Telemark Education Foundation is partnering together with the Wisconsin Humanities Council in Cable, Wisconsin, at their Natural History Museum, and they're putting on a three-part forum up there in August, August 6th, 13th, and the 20th. And each time they're having programs featured by a local naturalist and retired forester, and they're having slideshows and then a reading featuring Aldo Leopold. At each of the three things, it looks kind of right up the alley of the people that are interested in these subjects. I'm quite interested in it. It's three 2.5-hour sessions on August 6th, 13th, and 20th. And I'll give you a quick. I'm looking here at the website is www.telemarkeducation.com.
Telemarkeducation.com.
Yeah, and that's and there's a Deb at telemarkeducation.com for a personal organizer. She must be from the Cable History Museum. I think I've met her once.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Well, Jim, I thank you very much for calling. Comment, Joseph?
Well, I just want to let you know about some literature that I think that your listeners might be interested in. There's a book that's recently been published through the University through many of the faculty at the University of Wisconsin. It's called The Vanishing Present. It was edited by Donald Waller and Thomas Rooney. And it, I think, brings up to contemporary terms, contemporary times, a lot of the issues and the questions that we've been asking. And they bring about answers, or at least they raise the questions and try to answer, bring about solutions. So they look at, for example, the mounding through Kurt Mine, the view of man mound. They look at changes, the changing plant communities. They look at changing waters in the land-water interface, changing animal communities, nature meets us, the social and political context, and then trajectories. So you have within Wisconsin people that are grappling with the very hard questions and trying to come up with solutions.
Yeah. Thanks again, Jim, for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, with a question or comment as we visit with Joseph Inglesby. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. And before we get away, I should say that there are a lot of events going on, programs and so forth at the Arboretum that that you know a little about.
Yeah, well, certainly on the 21st, which is summer solstice, by the way, they're having programs that are open to the community of all age levels. They're having walks in the morning. The director, Kevin McSweeney, will be speaking at 12:30, and I believe that he's talking about the history of the Arboretum and the connections to Aldo Leopold and their vision for the future. I go on at 2. I believe there are refreshments for the public, and I believe that there's even a night walk that day. So there's always something happening there. But that day, the 75th anniversary celebration, there are quite a few events for the public.
Yeah, and in addition, people can see the panels that you have created.
That's correct. The Steinhauer Gallery will bring you through numbers of works. What I should do is let me describe a few of them.
Please.
For example, on the Fields Project, I worked, I believe it was in 2004, in the Rock River Valley on a piece called Silent Shadows of Whooping Cranes. And this was on a 20-acre parcel of fallow farm fields. It wasn't prairie. And what I did is I looked at the original migration route of the whooping crane, and it would have flown over the Rock River Valley. And what I did is I used global positioning. I did it in a drawing. I then gridded the drawing. I then used global positioning to locate the drawing on the landscape with the help of the farmers collaboratively in Oregon, Illinois. And what we did is we actually cut into the field a family of whooping cranes in flight. It could be seen from when you took a flight from Chicago to Madison. And that was to show the slender thread between an endangered species and an extinct species. And we really have to work hard, I think, to strengthen and thicken that thread. Now, coming up at the close of June, I leave Madison. I'll be returning for the Fields Project for a piece called Icons of the Vanishing Prairies. In this case, I've been given a large, in this case, flat piece of land to work on. And I'm creating a howling wolf, the American bison, and the eagle. And even though they may not be endangered species, they're certainly threatened. And I think the definitions of the endangered species could be put under a microscope. Because, for example, the American bison, if I'm not mistaken, even though there are large herds that are being developed for both for conservation as well as for the trade, in this case for the meat, from my readings, only a small percentage are genetically pure. And you have two breeds. You have a larger breed, and you have the breed that was of the prairies. There's been an intermixing with those breeds with the cattle. So it's actually a very small percentage of animals are genetically pure. And I think that that's in the hundreds versus in the hundreds of thousands. Someone can correct me if I'm wrong, but that's the readings that I had. The same with the threats to the American eagle. Now, they've come back with the banning of DDT and restrictions on hunting. With the wolves, it's always problematic because they are an animal, I think, that's sort of primal in sense. And so it may be harder to protect the wolves, but they certainly play a place have a place in the overall landscape and should be protected. And at Nisida National Wildlife Refuge, where I not only have been working on the crane effigy mounds, but I'm doing a piece called Silent Shadows of Whooping Cranes, in which a lot of the panels at the Arboretum show are made of paper. And there's an alcove there that I've set certain pieces that are representative. Others are shown graphically on photo panels, but these ones, the actual pieces. And I made them by, I actually made the paper out of plant materials that I gathered with a permit at Nisida, at the Prairies and Wetlands. And I combined that with both Japanese and other fibers that have a shrinking capacity. I made sculptural molds, and then a plaster mold from the clay, and then what I'd do is you would press in this handmade paper with its sheets. Mm-hmm. It makes a three-dimensional animal. So for the silent shadows at Nisida, what I'm doing is I'm creating a small flock, a family flock, of these paper birds, and they'll be put into the landscape at critical points, at observation decks, for example, so they won't interfere with the good work at Nisida, which I'm sure your listeners know is where they breed out the whooping cranes, an experimental flock, to fly via Operation Migration using ultralight planes to Chazahuitzka, Florida, which is their wintering ground on the Gulf Coast there. Now, even that is threatened, because if you look, and I've been there, if you look at it, it's very close to sea level. So any change that you're going to have there is obviously going to affect the winter habitat of the whooping crane and other species as well. So once again, it's showing a slender thread between an endangered species and an extinct species like the passenger pigeon.
I want to make sure that I have the date correct. It is Saturday. Is it Saturday or Sunday?
It's the 21st. I don't have a calendar in front of me. The 21st of June.
Okay, and I just want to make sure that I have that correct. If it's Saturday or Sunday, I want to make sure of that. And it is Sunday.
Oh, Sunday, yeah.
It is Sunday, and I've been talking. And in fact, your artist presentation is the 21st, and that and on the sheet we have Saturday, June 21st.
Oh,
but
really?
It is really, I believe it's Sunday, June 21st.
Oh, yeah.
Is Sunday. So
yeah.
So I want to make sure that we have this correct in people's minds before we chime off today, that it is the 21st.
It is the 21st, Sunday, the summer solstice. I know my cards have the 21st on it, and I think that was just a typo.
Just a typo. And, of course, your work will be on display from the 21st right up until the 29th, if I'm not mistaken, something like that?
That's correct. I dismantled the show on the 30th.
All right. It's been a great pleasure to speak with you today, Joseph. And again, he will be speaking at 2 o'clock on Sunday, June 21st, with an artist presentation and the topic, Vanishing Landscapes and Endangered Species. But come on out and spend the day. There's lots going on at the University of Wisconsin Arboretum. And Joseph Ingoldsby, thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
It's my pleasure. Coming up, we're going to take a look at energy efficiencies and energy policies. So we'll be doing that next on the Ideas Network with Susan Stratton, who's Executive Director of the Energy Center of Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.